Whatever It Takes, Tom Morello, the Night Watchman from the Fabled City. Just a great song. Someday I'd just like to turn it all the way up and just play it all the way through. And actually, you know, I put a lot of time into picking the songs for the show, and I think one time I'm just going to come in and say, okay, just play every song all the way through. Okay? We got 57 minutes. We can just play. We can take a couple minutes here, there, and play every song, because these songs, sometimes they're really killer songs, isn't it? You know, I always end up picking one more than necessary because I always think maybe I'll get a chance to play that song with. And sometimes I play it the next week, sometimes I don't. Anyway, we got a packed show today, and it's around things that should, that are controversial, and in some ways shouldn't be controversial. In some ways they should be straight up understood. So I want to let you know what we got in the back end of the show is we'll be talking with Gareth Porter, an investigative historian and journalist with Interpress Service who specializes in U.S. national security policy, and we'll be talking with him about Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan. And before that, we'll be talking to Scott Horton, a law professor and writer on legal and national security affairs. And before that, we're opening up the show, and actually with Scott, we'll be talking with Scott a lot about John Yoo, because John Yoo is going to be big in the news for the next couple of weeks, I think, at least around here, and he should be on everybody's mind. And before that, opening up the show, I'm really happy to welcome back Dennis Liu. Dennis is a professor at Cal Poly Pomona, associate professor of sociology at Cal Poly Pomona, and he's the co-editor of Impeach the President, the case against Bush and Cheney. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure.
Happy to say I got promoted to full professor, so I'm no longer an associate anymore, by the way.
Well, I'll have to fire my assistant then. is that associate professor job open right now? Anyway, well, congratulations, Dennis. I'm glad
Thank
to hear
you.
That. You know, I haven't had a chance to talk to you. I went back and forth an email very quickly, right after I saw your article on the World Can't Wait website, and I was really, really intrigued by it. And, I thought the kicker that you opened up with was something that we could actually start the show with, which is Hermann Göring's descendants file wrongful conviction and wrongful death claims. What the hell are you talking about, Dennis?
Yes, that was the kicker to the headline, which was, newsflash, Obama announces that the Nuremberg verdicts were wrong. And I was prompted to write that and have that headline and kicker to it because of the decision that recently was issued a few days ago by the Obama administration declaring that they were shutting down the CIA's so-called black sites where they had been renditioning people for torture in other countries. Like Egypt and Poland and Romania and so on, saying they were shutting them down, but they were also not going to prosecute any of the CIA interrogators who had tortured people because these people in the CIA had been following, according to Panetta, legal orders from above. And so, you know, he's saying we will not even look into it, let alone prosecute them for this, because they were following orders. Well, the Nuremberg verdicts, as anyone who knows about Nuremberg has heard, and certainly Obama, who is a constitutional lawyer, should know and does know, as does Panetta and the rest of the U.S. government. Nuremberg said, you know, the Nazi officers who were put on trial at Nuremberg for crimes against humanity, for committing atrocities, their defense was, most of them, we were just following orders. And Nuremberg said, following orders to commit atrocities is no excuse. You're guilty. So, you know, that's essentially what our government is now saying, that Nuremberg, in essence, was wrong. And as I was telling a colleague about this morning, you know, his response was, well, that was them. This is us. You know, he was saying sardonically, you know, right. When we do it, it's okay. When they do it, then it's, you know, a crime against humanity.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Now, you know, it's interesting because when Panetta announced this, I know from among a lot of people I know, there was things, because I had said to people, you know, things like, well, you know, look, they're not ending torture. They're not doing this, not doing that. And even making the proviso that they may have to actually, you know, do some backing up or some maneuvering. They will have tactical things that they'll make, you know, that they'll shift, and sometimes even dramatically. And, you know, but that the fundamental thing that they're doing in the world today is not changing in terms of its fundamental basis and its goal. But, you know, you make the argument, and I think, you know, when Panetta made this announcement, I actually got people calling me saying, see, he's shutting down the black sites, he's ending torture, you know, there's not going to be any more contract employees, you know, torturing people and whatnot. And, you know, you make the argument, you say, well, you say we can all breathe easier, things have changed. And then you say, except they haven't. So what do you mean they haven't changed?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't think we have time to go into all of them, but I'll try and hit the highlights here. You know, I know some of your other guests are going to hit some of the other highlights as well. Obama has announced on the record that that for certain so-called high-value detainees, they reserve the right to go beyond the Army Field Manual for interrogations. Meaning, yes, we have declared, and he did with great fanfare declare when he took office, that interrogations were now going to be limited to what is called for in the Army Field Manual. Well, you know, no, not exactly. You know, he's also said publicly, although not as with as much fanfare, that they will take some people and they reserve the right to do things beyond the manual, which means, you know, torture, essentially. And he's also said they will continue to use rendition. They're not going to abandon that technique. In fact, before I go on and mention a couple other details here, I want to say sort of more generally that I did not, you know, I wrote extensively about this prior to his, you know, while he was running for office. I said, look, you know, here is a man who is saying he's against what Bush has been doing, but if you look carefully at what he's actually saying, he's not, you know, his differences are tactical. You know, they're not over questions of morality or illegality. Or, you know, he's saying, well, they're just not doing it the right way. Not that these are wrong things to do in the first place. And so I knew that once he took office that he would be carrying forward the fundamental elements of the Bush program. What I did not anticipate, honestly, was that not only was he going to take the Bush program and carry it forward, but, in fact, he's gone even further, you know, and he's more dangerous for that reason than Bush and Cheney, who are widely exposed as, you know, reactionary. Because Obama looks the way that he does and the way he presents himself is so seductive to a lot of people, the fact that he's going beyond what Bush and Cheney did makes him more dangerous because people are not seeing clearly what he's doing. So, you know, that's sort of a more general comment. He said publicly, to get to some more of the details here, that, you know, I'm closing Gitmo, and he did that the day after he took office. But, you know, it's going to take him a year or, you know, so to do it. Meanwhile, the reports from Guantanamo are that torture has gotten worse, since he got elected, and he's not doing anything about that. You know, when they say, as Panetta and Obama have said, we will not investigate, let alone punish or prosecute these people who did this torture, which they have said was torture. You know, Eric Holder, when he was before the Senate in confirmation hearings, said on the record, waterboarding is torture. You know, Panetta has said these things are torture. Obama has said, we do not torture, by implication meaning, you know, they recognize that the Bush administration was torturing people. And yet, they aren't going to investigate, not only not investigate even underlings, but by implication, of course, they're not going to investigate the people who ordered this torture to take place from Bush on down through people like John Yoo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people should be paying closer attention to what's going on.
Well, let me ask you about this, about specifically about renditioning, because, yes, you know, Panetta made the announcement that they're getting rid of the black sites. Now, for a lot of people, renditioning basically was intimately involved, connected up with black sites.
Right.
So how, you know, and yet you said that they're not really going to end renditioning. How do you explain that?
Well, they've said we're not going to end renditioning, first of all. They've publicly said that we are going to continue to do rendition. The difference they said that they're going to carry out is that they are not going to send people to places knowingly that these people are going to be tortured. Okay? Mm-hmm. And but why do you rendition people in the first place if not for the purposes of, you know, torture?
Right.
You know, you do it in order... I mean, that's why... that's why Clinton, who started rendition, was doing it in his administration. They started it, actually. The Democrats started rendition. Bush and Cheney, you know, they took it to a whole new level. And so the thing about Obama is that what he is doing is he is spinning things very differently. And you know, he says that he's doing one thing. In the New York Times article, one of the interviews with him last month, the New York Times, you know, he says in the course of this interview, you know, that you have the right ultimately to challenge your detention, you know, if you are being held by us, meaning you have habeas corpus rights. And he, in fact, during the campaign, he declared very publicly, habeas corpus is a foundation of Anglo-American law. That's a quote, you know. Mm-hmm. And then he comes into office. Now he's president of the United States, and he is no longer, you know, he says in this interview for the New York Times, you ultimately have the right to challenge your detention. And then soon after he says this, his aides contacted the New York Times reporters on this interview and clarified the record, saying, well, he didn't really mean everyone. You know, he doesn't mean Bagram, where there are some 600 prisoners being held. And he doesn't mean anyone who was being detained before June 2008. So, you know, this principle that is supposed to be, according to his own words during the campaign, a foundation of Anglo-American law is suddenly something that is not applicable to hundreds of people in Bagram, which is, by the way, being doubled in size by Obama. And I expect some of the prisoners, at least of those who are now at Gitmo, are going to get shipped to Bagram, where he's, you know, publicly said they don't have a right to challenge their detention. And, you know, June 2008, you know, because there are people who have, there were some people who were being held at Guantanamo. They were fortunately finally released, but not after they were, until after they were tortured at Guantanamo. And they were captured doing, they were turned in for bounty by, you know, other forces, to the United States forces, while they were doing humanitarian work in Afghanistan. These are the people, you know, the worst of the worst, as Bush put it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people doing humanitarian work.
Exactly, and people who want to get a sense of Bagram should look, get a copy of the Taxi to the Dark Side, that film.
Yes.
It's just
powerful film.
Yes, very powerful. Yeah. And you get a real sense of what it means to be in Bagram and Guantanamo, what it means to be, you know, tortured under the rule of the U.S. Now, one more thing, Dennis. You are also on the National Steering Committee of World Can't Wait. What is it that you know, and it's clear to me one of the things that's happening here now is, you know, in terms of the opposition to this and in terms of what you were talking about, Obama being able to get away with a lot of this stuff, is that there's been a real collapse of the movement in a certain sense, to a certain degree.
Yep.
And it's just outrageous. And a lot of it has been because people have just folded up their tents behind the Democratic Party and Obama. What does World Can't Wait say about that?
Well, we say that's terrible and it can't be accepted, and we have to change, you know, we have to change the terms. We have to continue to speak out. We have to reconstitute the anti-war movement, which has, as you said, you know, collapsed. You know, some of the leaders of, like, Move On and United for UFPJ, United for Peace and Justice leadership, has, you know, become part of the Obama administration, essentially. That now that the war is being prosecuted under a Democratic president, they're saying, well, suddenly this war that they were so opposed to is now okay. You know, we'll tell that to the Afghanis and the Pakistanis and the Iraqis, you know, who are being killed by our our intervention, our illegal invasion and occupations of their countries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is. Are you going to mention the events coming up?
You can go ahead and mention them.
Okay. Well, there's a teach-in on Saturday, and it's a teach-in about. It's entitled "National Security, Rule of Law, and Torture," and it's a teach-in that's going to be happening at Chapman University School of Law. It's hosted by the National Lawyers Guild, and, you know, World Can't Wait is helping to put this together. And it's going to be a teach-in about the torture memos of John Yoo, who is a UC Berkeley Law School professor who is now a visiting professor at Chapman University. So that's this Saturday, April 18th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Chapman University School of Law. You can contact World Can't Wait. WorldCan'tWait.net. If you go to the Los Angeles chapter on the website, you can find out about it, or you can call this number 949-257-8501. 949-257-8501.
Okay. All right, Dennis. Well, thank you very much. And
welcome.
We're going to listen, I know you're a quick mover, so the next time I have you on, you're going to be a dean, right?
No, I don't want to be in administration.
Okay. All right, man. Dennis, thank you very much.
You're welcome, we'll talk
to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will hopefully be talking with Scott Horton, but maybe you'll hear a full song this time, okay?
This Friday, April 17, KPFK listeners will have a chance to experience a brave new world, all while supporting their favorite radio station in the meantime. The science fiction film Sleep Dealer, opening widely this April 17, is a Sundance Award-winning film that looks at the future of America from south of the border, filling the screen with lush visuals and big ideas on war, the environment, and militarization. KPFK will benefit from ticket sales from opening weekend. See the movie and then drop off ticket stubs you collect on the 17th, 18th, and 19th of April, and then drop them off at KPFK or Amish Bookstore in Eagle Rock, or mail them into the station, attention, Sleep Dealer. This is a film event for friends, familia, and co-workers, and will benefit your community radio station, KPFK. More information is available at www.kpfk.org.
Thank you for pledging to KPFK in our recent fund drive. If you haven't paid your pledge yet, please do so as soon as you can. Your support is vitally important to Free Speech Radio. KPFK is powered by the people. People like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sending your payment right away.
See, that's one of those songs that I really want to play all the way through. I actually want to play that album all the way through. That is an amazing, amazing album. It's called Darkest Light, the best of the Lafayette Afro-American rock band. And it's 70s funk at its best. It's just an incredible piece. And if you listen closely, you'll hear a lot of that gets sampled a lot in hip-hop these days. I want to say my next guest, I'm really excited about having him on. Years after leaving his government position, John Yoo continues to be, and for good reason, one of the most controversial members of the Bush Gang. Although, in my opinion, you should not be as controversial as he is. As I said when we were opening up the show, things seem to me to be fairly straightforward. You as a war criminal. Full stop. He's currently teaching at Chapman University Law School while still tenured at Berkeley. And there's going to be a forum, as Dennis Liu pointed out earlier. There'll be a forum. We'll announce again at the end at Chapman this coming Saturday at the law school. I think it's running from 10 to 2. 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, April 18th at the law school at Chapman. Here to talk with us about John Yoo is Scott Horton. Scott's a professor at the Columbia Law School, as well as a writer on legal and national security affairs for Harper's Magazine and The American Lawyer, among other publications. And in addition, he has also coined what I consider to be the most apt description of John Yoo I have ever read. Something that I can't get out of my mind, unfortunately, but it's really apt. An indefatigable advocate of crushing the testicles of young children to extract actionable intelligence. That's John Yoo in all of his glory. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
Sure. You know, as I said, there continues to be raging controversy around Yoo and his past and even more so these days, his future. You've argued pretty powerfully over the last period of time that Yoo is, in fact, not just facing facing, you know, censure in the academic world is the least of his problems, that he actually may, in fact, be liable for criminal prosecution. Why do you say that?
Well, it's no longer hypothetical. It's actually going on right now. In fact, that was a major news development today. The Spanish prosecutors attached to the Audiencia Nacional, the Central Criminal Court, have announced that they are proceeding with criminal charges against John Yoo and five of his confederates.
Who are the other five?
The other five are Alberto Gonzalez, David Addington, Jim Haynes, Douglas Feith, and Jay Bybee, who was John Yoo's boss.
Mm-hmm.
He's named because he's the individual who actually signed off on the memoranda that John Yoo wrote.
Mm-hmm.
The Spanish action was commenced coming out of an investigation into allegations that five Spanish citizens who were held at Guantanamo were tortured. That's been under investigation since July of 2006, and it led to a review of how these procedures in Guantanamo came to be instituted, and the prosecutors have concluded that it's appropriate to begin a criminal investigation of the lawyers who issued legal opinions that made this torture system possible, and John Yoo sits right at the center of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, when you look at these, at Yoo's, and when you're talking about him sitting at the center, these memos that he's written, you know, and it's just astounding. I mean, you go through all of them, but there's a few that are even more astounding than the others. They assault every major moral, ethical, and legal position you can possibly have in your life. And, you know, as you're saying, they violate all kinds of laws, domestic laws, international laws, laws that have been, you know, the Geneva Convention. All of these things are just thrown out the window. But there's really a couple of these memos that stand up very sharply in relation to this inhuman argument they've made around torture. Can you talk about them some?
Well, I think that the memo that is generally referred to by shorthand as the torture memorandum was authored in August 2002, and it was issued to Alberto Gonzalez. And it appears to have been crafted to give green light to the CIA's introduction of a torture system. Now, we don't really know all the facts surrounding the memo, and John Yoo has made a number of public statements in which he suggested that, well, this was just him engaging in some sort of abstract legal exercise. I think it's pretty clear now that that's false, and there is an internal ethics review that's been prepared about it inside the Department of Justice by their Office of Professional Responsibility. That memorandum was completed in October of last year. It hasn't yet been issued, but it excoriates Yoo basically on ethical grounds, saying that he violated the most fundamental professional standards in writing the memo. But it also goes into a lot of detail about how the memo came to be created. And it suggests that, in fact, this torture system was out there, had been put into place a period of several months before Yoo started writing his memo, and that Yoo was asked to craft a memo to provide what we legally call CYA coverage for these people, to ensure that they would not be criminally prosecuted, because they would have a Department of Justice memorandum to cite back to. And in this memo, he talks about the definition of torture. He defines it down, basically saying at one point that anything that the president chooses to authorize is definitionally not torture. And then he also says that those who, acting on the president's instructions, do these things have the benefit of all sorts of extraordinary defenses, including necessity and self-defense, things which mark an astonishing departure from prior Department of Justice positions. So this memo, when it was issued, it's being used as a shield for people who are engaged in torture. It's also being used to hammer down people who are opposing the torture regime. Basically, they're told, this is the Attorney General's opinion, you must honor it. This is the official law of our government. So it's used in a very proactive way. So I think those who raise questions about John Yoo, there's no issue. He's entitled to have whatever completely nutty opinions he wants to have. That's not a problem. The issue here is the instrumentalization of these opinions, the fact that they're actually used to set up the torture system. They're an essential part of the inducements that make the system run. And, you know, that's one of the conclusions that the Spanish prosecutors reached today when they decided to go forward with this case against John Yoo.
You know, that's one of the things that actually comes that has been argued strenuously by people who the dean at Berkeley, at Bolt Hall, and then, you know, it's also been argued by people I know around, you know, just in general, talking about you and should he be allowed to teach and all this, is that he was an advisor. He was just somebody who formulated ideas. He's an academic. And even when he was there, when he was serving in the Bush regime, he was basically saying he was offering his opinion, but that he can't be prosecuted for offering his opinion. He's not, how did the dean at Berkeley put it? He's not the decider. And there's a difference between the advisor and the decider.
Exactly. I mean, that was Chris Edley's argument. And I, in fact, wrote a piece in the Los Angeles Times responding to that, saying that, that was simply incorrect as a statement of law. I mean, quite clearly erroneous. In fact, there are a significant number of cases in which lawyers have been prosecuted for issuing opinions. There's no immunity for it. And these cases frequently involve facts in which it appears that the issuance of the opinion is critical to orchestrating, setting up, or carrying out the crime. In fact, the Justice Department has a major prosecution pending in Miami, Florida, today against a very prominent lawyer based on an opinion he issued. And in this particular context, we have very unequivocal, very clear guidance from 1946-1947, a case that at the end of World War II was originally arranged by Robert H. Jackson, probably our most famous attorney general, in which he decided to prosecute a number of German Justice Department lawyers. And part of that case, two fairly senior Justice Department lawyers were prosecuted for issuing legal memoranda, which gave the green light to creating a system very much like our extraordinary rendition system. And in this process, they overrode the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Convention. They explained why this isn't binding and why the government was perfectly free to go ahead and set up the special internment system. This wasn't the concentration camps we associate with the Holocaust. It was a program called the Fog and Night Program that was run in France. And these lawyers were prosecuted, convicted, and sentenced, and the sentence was 10 years, and they actually wound up serving 7 years. They got off some time for good behavior. But that also gives you some sense of our own Justice Department's view of what the appropriate sanction is for this sort of infraction.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, interestingly enough, I mean, there's this point around this, the difference between advisors and deciders, and exactly what you're saying. And how does that fit in with this, the Jose Padilla case, which actually, I mean, you think about that, and he currently has there's a case against you, right? Is it a civil case against you?
It is a civil case he's commenced against you, in which he's seeking $1 as damages, in fact. So it's basically to establish a principle. Mm-hmm. And Jose Padilla says that he was tortured and mistreated, and this occurred directly because of memoranda and advice that John Yoo gave. And in fact, about 6 weeks ago, the Department of Justice declassified and released some of these John Yoo memoranda dealing with the Jose Padilla case. And I think most people who read these memoranda came to the conclusion that that Mr. Padilla's case is certainly not frivolous. It's clear that John Yoo is giving advice, saying that this man, because he's been labeled by the president as an enemy combatant, doesn't have the normal constitutional protections and rights that an American citizen would normally have, that he can be placed in solitary confinement, that he can be tortured, that he has no right to present his case to a judge, and so forth. And in fact, John Yoo gave that advice, and as a result, all of those things happened to Mr. Padilla. So it seems to me that just on a causal level, there's absolutely no question there's a direct connection between his mistreatments, his torture, and the memos that John Yoo wrote.
Now, let's return for a minute to the cover your ass memos, just in case people didn't get what CYA was. You know, basically, there's a couple questions that come up to that in my mind. One is the, you know, part of this is, you know, you look at these things that in a way, him going back, and as you said, and I thought you really, you know, very powerfully put it, as, you know, this sort of going backwards on this thing and starting from what was going on and going backwards. And there's so many examples, even that December memo from Haynes that talked about, you know, gave to Rumsfeld, anybody who followed Guantanamo at all, the whole thing of Rumsfeld's comments and the checking off of what was approved of the list of tortures that was attached to the memo. And that memo was based on a memo that you had written earlier. And that this all happened, there was like days or weeks ahead of time, there was already this man in Guantanamo who had already gone through 57 days or something of torture using many of the same techniques that they were listing 10 days later as, can we get these approved? And so what it raises is this idea of, even in the sense of terms of legally, is you part, you know, you've mentioned this, you sort of hit at this a little bit, but is John Yoo actually guilty of part of a conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy around this, to cover this stuff up?
I think that, well, that's in fact what the prosecutors in Spain are charging. I mean, they're saying that there was a conspiracy. That's how they bring together these six lawyers, and they're saying that their actions collectively produced the torture regime. So, and I think a lot of people who've looked at it have said that, you know, conspiracy, that's more the English language way of putting it, or joint criminal enterprise, that's more the way the Europeans view it. Definitely that theory can be brought to bear here. But I think, you know, key point, I mean, John Yoo in his public statements is constantly saying, well, they came to me with a problem and asked me to give them my best advice. And I think everybody's looked at these papers now, and evidently the internal investigation by the Department of Justice, say, horse feathers. That's just not possible. What happened here is that this system was in place. It was being used. It had been used for a period of many, many months, and then some people in the CIA and the Department of Defense raised objections saying, you know, this is torture, it's criminal, people can be prosecuted as a result of this, and they brought John Yoo in basically saying, give us a golden shield. You write us an opinion in the name of the Attorney General that will protect us from being prosecuted. And John Yoo fully understood that was the mission he was being given. And, of course, that means that if a crime was going on, and it was, that's the view of the current Attorney General, Eric Holder, he was being brought in to use the power and authority of the Attorney General to promote this criminal operation, to keep it going, to silence those people who are making objections, and to get the program to continue. And he fully understand that when he wrote the memos. And, you know, he wrote and issued the memos to that end. That makes him a participant in the conspiracy.
And that would go, that actually potentially could go very, very, you know, all the way through the White House.
I think in the end it does. I mean, we don't know the full scope of it. I'd say all the papers and documents that have come out so far give us a sense of maybe a third of everything that happened. Some of the most recent revelations, the Red Crosses, the detailed report that Mark Danner published just last weekend, weekend one back, that points to there being an elaborate approval process that went through the National Security Council in the White House. And Colin Powell, when he was recently interviewed by Rachel Maddow, said there's a vast amount of paper about this that documents everything that the public hasn't yet seen. And Colin Powell, to his great credit, said it's very important that all this come out and that people know what happened. So I think that, you know, there is a great deal we need to know, and a lot of the information we don't know occurred in the White House. No doubt about that.
But we do know enough for my last two questions, Scott. And I want to remind listeners, I'm Michael Slayton. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And I'm speaking now with Scott Horton about John Yoo and the recent action by the Spanish court system and John Yoo in general. And Scott, John Yoo, with the Spanish court taking its actions, you know, is he subject to citizens' arrests?
Maybe extraordinary rendition, huh?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, at this point, he will be gravely at risk being outside of the United States anywhere. Mm-hmm. If he landed anywhere in Europe, in any of the 25 countries, he could be immediately arrested now under a European arrest warrant, which the judge could issue at any minute. And then we have the question of extradition requests. And I think it's, you know, conceivable, certainly, that at some point they would do that. But if John Yoo certainly were to be found on Spanish soil, you know, he would be subject to being arrested and confined. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the former Attorney General Gonzalez or any of the other six.
Right. One final question now, and I'm tempted to say, Scott, John Yoo, war criminal or college professor? But I'd still put that to you, but I'd also say, you know, what would you say to people who say, look, he should be allowed to teach. He should be allowed to be teaching in a law school. I think it's worth reemphasizing and just stating flat out, what is your feeling, what is your belief about whether or not John Yoo should be walking around teaching in a law school?
I think it's a very serious issue. And frankly, again, you look at 1946 and the lawyer's case there, and what did the United States do? I mean, the United States prosecuted and sentenced people, and it also revoked the right of many of these people to teach. It said you're just not going to be permitted to teach youngsters because your ideas are dangerous. That's something the U.S. did in Europe. It's not something we've ever done domestically in the United States, but I would say there's a very serious question for the University of California here about why someone like John Yoo should be teaching international law, considering what he did in these memoranda in the Department of Justice.
I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, for me, it's a question. Look, if somebody is an academic, and no matter what they're putting forward in terms of whether, however, you know, it's reactionary or it's repugnant or whatever, is, you know, if they're putting forward things that they believe that they've developed within the academy, that's one thing. You're not going to fire somebody for that, no matter how repugnant you find it. But for somebody who's actually been part and parcel of the implementation, the facilitation of torture around the world and the justification of all this, that is, to me, unacceptable. So, Scott Horton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, and we'll have to have you back again sometime soon, man.
Happy to come back. Maybe we'll have more news from Spain next.
All right, we'll keep in touch around that. All right, Scott, thank you very much.
Take care. Bye.
I'm Michael Slayton. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Gareth Porter about the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thank you.
was about a British chick and real.
All right, welcome back. You know, it hurts like hell to stop this song. It's a cover by Lily Allen and Mick Jones of Straight to Hell, The Clash of Straight to Hell, and it's from War Child Heroes, an album benefiting victims, child victims of war. And I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show now Gareth Porter. Gareth has been on the show. He's on the show once before, but he's always out there. You're always coming across his name. If you do any reading of any of the progressive columns, if you read Interpress Service, Gareth's name is always there, and he's always writing things that you want to know. And Gareth's an investigative historian and journalist with Interpress, and he specializes in U.S. national security policy. And we're going to be talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, and if we get a chance, Iran. Gareth, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be back.
Sure. Well, let's jump into it. We're rushed on time now, but let's jump into it. Iraq. You've written a tremendous amount here, you know, and in particular about the amazing amount of maneuvering that has gone on in the Obama administration and going on around Iraq, and the how many troops are going to be there, how many troops are going to stay, where were the combat troops going to be, what were they going to do. And I came across your piece actually right after I had seen John Stewart's piece. Did you actually happen to catch John Stewart's little video about the after the Lejeune speech?
I did.
Yeah. It's kind of, in a lot of ways, John Stewart, he beat out everybody on that one.
He was wonderful.
It was great. So why don't we talk about that maneuvering and what the upshot of it all has been?
Well, you know, it's to me, this is the first real test of whether Barack Obama is going to be a progressive president or is going to, you know, with regard to his policy in the Middle East specifically, whether he's going to be a progressive president or whether he's going to slip sort of bit by bit or in much larger gulps into a sort of George W. Bush kind of policymaking in which he essentially uses deception in order to sell a policy to the American people in order to get sort of the minimum of political support for the policy. And I know this is what I saw as the real headline in his February 27th speech announcing his withdrawal or his drawdown plan for Iraq. And, of course, he promised the American people in that speech that he was going to withdraw the combat brigades that the United States had in Iraq by the end of August 2010. In fact, we have very good reason to believe that he knew perfectly well that that was not going to happen at all, and that what was going to happen was, or is, that the combat brigades would be drawn down. It's true, there would be fewer combat brigades, but they were not going to be all withdrawn, but in fact would be renamed as non-combat brigades, or brigades with names that would not have combat in them.
As John Stewart said, the Cable Installation Brigade.
That's right, exactly. And that that there would be a very large number of combat troops remaining in Iraq in the normal combat formations, the normal organization of Army and Marine Corps combat troops that the United States has had in Iraq now for more than 6 years. That basically the only thing that would change is there would be a fewer number of these brigades, but there will still be several of the combat brigades, and they will simply have, in addition to the existing combat troops, there will also be a relatively small number of officers who do advising on the job, if you will, with their Iraqi counterparts in the Iraqi Army police units. They'll be out in the field with them, doing the advising and actually helping them carry out operations. And by the way, this is a good formula, a perfectly good formula for the United States to continue to be drawn into combat situations and to actually be involved in combat whenever their Iraqi counterparts choose essentially to draw them in, or whenever the political leadership of Iraq decides to have their combat troops be carrying out combat. The U.S. Combat brigades will be drawn into that ipso facto. It's going to be their job to do so.
Gareth, in your March 26th article, you made a point, though, that the only change, and that article was entitled "The Big Con on Iraq," and that was in Counterpunch. And you know, you made the point that the only change to the existing brigade combat team structure that's being planned is the addition of advisory and assistance skills, which is what you're talking about now, rather than any reduction in combat power. So in other words, these groups will still be organized exactly the same way they are and still have all the same firepower they have.
That's exactly right. I mean, they will still be capable of actually not just calling in airstrikes, but carrying out artillery assaults, artillery attacks, having combat troops, engaged in maneuver battle. Battalions will be engaged in maneuver battles if they do get into a fight. There's absolutely no difference in the kind of combat they will carry out. If and when, and I think it's fair to say that the chances are very good. They've already, begun, to carry out the sort of combat that I think we will see continuing beyond August 2010. Just a few weeks ago in Baghdad, when the Iraqi military was going into a neighborhood in Baghdad to round up Sunni fighters who were on the U.S. payroll until very recently, who came in from the insurgency and who were on the U.S. payroll and who now are supposed to be paid by the Iraqi government, but they're not being paid, and whose commander was detained by the Iraqi government. And the supporters, the armed men under that commander, basically had an uprising. And so the United States was drawn into combat to actually try to round up and disarm these people. And that, as I reported at the time, is a kind of model for the sort of combat that we can expect the U.S. troops to be involved in continuously now until really at least late 2011. And you had helicopters flying overhead. You had U.S. Combat forces on the ground involved in the combat.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to remember, though, too, I think that, in any of these situations, I always feel obliged to always point out to people that the relationship between the tail and the dog, and who's wagging who, because it's, the U.S. remains there not because of any, commitment to the Iraqi government or the Iraqi people, but because of its strategic commitment, its strategic needs in the world. And, to me, they're looking for the way to carry this out that best serves their interests. And
this is precisely the point that I think needs to be underlined. I agree with you completely. What is happening there and what has been happening really ever since Barack Obama emerged as a significant candidate in the spring of 2008 is that military leaders in Washington and in the command in Iraq and also since then, at least, at CENTCOM in Tampa, which is General David Petraeus, the CENTCOM chief there, they have been basically talking among themselves and trying to come up with a way in which they could prevent an Obama administration from actually withdrawing U.S. combat troops from Iraq. They were determined to avoid that, and they came up with this formula in late 2008. It was reported in the New York Times twice during December 2008 that they had come up with this policy, the strategy, if you will, of relabeling the combat forces, the combat brigades, as non-combat forces, and basically keeping them in Iraq well past the 16-month withdrawal date, that the timeline that Barack Obama had talked about during the campaign. And that's exactly what they proposed to the president, and which he basically caved in on in the first months of his new administration. But instead of coming clean to the American people, he instead, as I suggested earlier, has essentially presented this as something that it simply is not, which is a real withdrawal of U.S. combat brigades.
And I would be tempted to ask, what more could people expect from somebody other who wants to, who's the commander in chief?
And I think that's right. I mean, there is a structural element of this which is obviously very important, that any president is going to be confronted with a national security state, and particularly a military leadership in the field, the field commanders who have great power, they have great legitimacy, what Gramsci called ideological hegemony. They use their influence within the media to get their argument across. This is exactly what happened after Obama was elected. There was an immediate spate of articles talking about how the president, of course, will have to listen to his generals and do what they say, because obviously he doesn't know what the score is, and he has to have a responsible withdrawal, which they interpreted as meaning withdrawal based on conditions on the ground, not on his timetable.
And I'm sure Obama, as much as I think, you know, look, to me, in my mind, Obama is simply serving the needs of the system, and there's not any question that that's what he's going to do. But I'm sure he's also very keenly aware of where the officer corps sits in relation to the military, and they got very big guns.
Absolutely. I mean, he's somebody who he does not have the energy and the time to ride herd on this issue from day to day. He has to depend on a Secretary of Defense who is clearly part of the cabal, if you will, part of the group of military officers and civilian officials who have engineered this policy of keeping the combat brigades in Iraq. And, of course, that means that he inevitably is going to have to submit to the strategy that the military has chosen.
Yeah, I'd also have to say, though, too, Gareth, is that, you know, I think it's really, you know, Obama, he appointed all these people, and it's a question of who's serving who here, and he's, you know, and again, who's wagging what, and Obama's actually there to serve the interests of this system, and that, to me, that's a critical point. I don't want you to leave there without saying something about Afghanistan. We have about 3 minutes to do Afghanistan.
What I was going to say is that the same thing that Obama did, in principle, on Iraq, he has also done on Afghanistan. That is to say, he presented to the American people a rationale for escalation militarily in Afghanistan based on an argument that the United States is basically fighting al-Qaeda in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, that simply is not true, that the United States is actually fighting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That was a political fiction which Obama and his advisors cooked up in order to sell that policy to the American people. And I have interviewed a number of analysts, former officials, and national security analysts, intelligence analysts, who have said to me that it's very clear that Obama and his advisors were afraid that if they did not point to the idea of an al-Qaeda threat in Afghanistan, that they were afraid that the American people would not support this escalation in that country. And I think that's correct. He had to do in Afghanistan in a way equivalent to the WMD rationale in Iraq, a kind of false case for war. And I think that's another case where Obama has taken a major step towards simply becoming a George Bush in the way he handles war and peace issues.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because even now you look at the outreach to the elements of the Taliban in Afghanistan. It's very interesting, even saying that they're you know, that if they would just renounce certain of the things that they've done, that, you know, then they could actually, we could all, you know, sit down and break bread and talk about some kind of alliance. But he's certainly not talking about, you know, the horrendous way that they've treated women, or the Islamic law, and what that's meant to people. You know, he's like, there's a whole question of, can they work with these feudal warlords and these Islamic fundamentalists to a degree?
Well, there are so many issues that arise in looking at this policy in Afghanistan. I mean, you have to begin with the utter unreality of the idea that the United States is going to be able to bring off a policy which is going to somehow weaken the Taliban to the extent that they're going to, you know, start to break up, and, you know, 70% or 40% or even 25% of the Taliban is going to walk in and hand over their arms. I mean, the fact is the Taliban knows that they are on the winning side at this point. This is common knowledge in Afghanistan. It's simply not in the cards that the United States is going to be able to bring that off. Then if you look at Pakistan, it's even a more unrealistic notion that the United States is going to somehow change the reality by the means that it has at hand, which is drone attacks to try to take out individual al-Qaeda or Taliban leaders there. This is a policy that bears no resemblance to reality.
It simply ends up in slaughtering the people. Gareth, we have to wrap this up now, but I want to thank you very much for joining us.
And my pleasure.
Keep your writing, man, because we need to understand this stuff about what's going on there, the truth about what's going on there. All right, I've been speaking with Gareth Porter, and I'm Michael Slayton. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Real quick, a rehash, a forum on national security, rule of law, and torture, the torture memos of John Yoo, this Saturday, April 18th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Chapman University Law School. That's in the city of Orange, Kennedy Hall, rooms 237 A and B. Speakers are Catherine Darmer, a professor at Chapman, Larry Everest, Ann Fagan Ginger, Tim Goodrich of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, Amina Kwasi, the staff attorney for Council on American Islamic Relations, and I'll be moderating the discussion.